There's a new invasive pest in Iowa. The spotted winged Drosophila fly has been found in Story County. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. We're all familiar with some kinds of Drosophila flies. They're the ones that show up in your kitchen when the bananas go bad. Today, we'll talk about this new kind of fruit fly and the threat it poses to fruit crops in Iowa. Horticulturist Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension will also be here. Donald and Richard will answer your questions about plants and bugs. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and Richard Giron will join us in a moment from Iowa State University Extension. Of course, we'll be taking your questions today about plants. We're also going to be talking about bugs, too. With us is Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
And, of course, a lot of us know what fruit flies are, but there is a new fruit fly in Iowa that we need to be concerned about, right?
Yes, we do. It's not one that we're very happy to talk about, but it's a pest that we have been expecting. The fact that we were expecting it, people were actually looking for it, and that's how it was detected here in Story County, quite a ways removed from the other known infested areas, and that would be parts of southern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois, where they had already reported the spotted wing Drosophila. Drosophila is the genus of many fruit flies, but to be more technically accurate, we really call these vinegar flies because these are the ones that are attracted to the fermentation products of overripe fruits and vegetables. So you'll see different names for this group. You'll see them called vinegar flies. You'll see them called fruit flies. And you'll also just see them called by their genus name, Drosophila. And it's a very large group. And now we have one more in that group.
Where does the spotted winged Drosophila come from?
This is another insect from Asia. We have used that name several times now as we talk about invasive species that are new to the United States. Emerald ash borer probably came from that area, the pest of ash trees that we're watching, the Asian long-horned beetle, a pest of maple trees that's found in Chicago, Ohio, and New York, probably came from that region of the world. So our trade relations, the movement of products around the world is continuing to bring us these invasive species that we've never dealt with before. Once they get here, they kind of explode on us because it's new virgin territory for them.
Now, as I mentioned, a lot of us know what fruit flies are. A lot of us have seen Drosophila flies, not just in our biology lab classes in college, but in our own kitchens. What makes the spotted winged Drosophila different from what we're used to seeing?
The common household fruit fly, Drosophila melangaster, for those of you who remember the genetics experiments where you raise these little red-eyed fruit flies in little glass bottles, that one and almost all of its cousins are attracted to overripe fruit, and if there is an opening in that fruit, if there is a place they can lay their eggs into the fermenting pulp of the fruit, they will do so. What makes the spotted winged Drosophila different is the female fly doesn't have the patience to wait for the fruit to be overripe, to wait for the fruit to be damaged. She saws her way right into fresh fruit that's perfectly intact just as it's starting to get ripe. She saws her way in and lays her eggs in the fruit before it has a chance to mature.
That doesn't sound good. What happens to the fruit then?
Well, as you remember from the biology class, fruit flies have a complete life cycle. All flies have a complete life cycle of four stages: egg, larva, pupa, and adult. And those eggs that are laid into slits cut by the female's ovipositor hatch into larvae. those little tiny white larvae, and if you're not being completely delicate, you can refer to them as maggots. Those little white larvae begin to feed on the fruit, and as they feed, the fruit begins to decay because there's an opening, fungi and bacteria move in, and very quickly the fruit starts to break down and rot. The fruit starts to decay, and very quickly, within just a few days, becomes completely inedible.
The spotted wing Drosophila, obviously we're looking for spotted wings, but these are tiny, tiny flies. How were they even identified?
The tiny as in an eighth of an inch, meaning, yes, you can see them. They are visible to the naked eye. You know they're a fly. You're going to put them in that broad category of this is another gnat. But with magnification, and it doesn't take a lot of magnification, with a 10x hand lens, you can probably see the characteristics. But all the fruit flies in that group have red eyes and striped abdomens and kind of a tannish off-white colored body. And then what makes this one different under magnification, if you're looking at males, they have a spot out near the tip of each wing. Flies, of course, only have two wings, and in the tip of each wing, there is a discernible, distinct spot. But that only happens in the males. For the females, we have to turn them over, look at the underside, and you see this protruding saw blade coming off the end of the abdomen. And that saw blade is the ovipositor that she uses to slit or saw a slot into the fruit, and then that's where she lays her eggs. So those two characteristics allow us to identify this one as different from the other Drosophila. But what most people are going to notice is, oh, there are these tiny little white fly larvae in my fruit that is almost ripe. That's going to be what most people will notice, and that's how they will detect the spotted wing Drosophila.
In the areas that already have infestations, how bad does it get?
It gets really bad, and it can get bad. It can get very bad quickly. In some areas where this snuck up on them, there will be so many fruit infested that there's no reason to pick the crop, and they just declare it a total loss. This fly prefers soft fleshed fruit. So we're thinking strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, some of the softer variety of grapes. They will get into apples, but that's a little harder to penetrate with the saw blade ovipositor. So it's those soft fruits like blueberries that ripen in the fall of the year, late summer to the fall of the year, that we're most worried about. And total loss of crops has been reported.
Wow. How quickly does this insect spread?
Well, it doesn't get around very fast on its own. And if we trace back the history, of course, it was in Asia. Then it was found in Hawaii back in the 1980s. And the quarantines that keep fruit from traveling from Hawaii to the mainland of the United States worked very well for us. This insect was not found in California until 2008. And then very quickly, it moved up the Pacific seaboard, up the Pacific coast, all the way to Canada. It jumped the United States. It was found in Florida in 2009. It's all the way from Florida to Ohio to Maine in just a period of a couple, 3 years. So the fly is probably not getting around that far, that fast, all on its own. But as we ship fruit around the country, as we ship fruit around the world, we probably aided in this transportation. So your question, how fast does it move, depends on whether you put it on a truck or a jet airplane, and it will travel the speed of those modes of transportation.
Now, pardon me, now that it's been found in Story County, what does that mean for Iowa?
It means it's probably in lots of other places. The reason it was found in Story County is people here were looking. Researchers that are involved with fruit and vegetable production have been watching for this. We have been anticipating it. They were putting up the traps. The trap is just a little tub of vinegar that you hang along among your fruit crops. And that's how it was detected, was with a trapping program that was specifically looking for it. Because it was found in Story County, not because it landed here first. In all likelihood, it was found here first because we were looking harder than other places. But as we begin to look through the rest of Iowa, I expect it's probably already in regions of northern Iowa, and we'll find out more as the word spreads to be looking for it. And as people begin to examine their fruit crop next summer, we'll probably have more reports and it will look like a rapid spread, whereas that spread has probably already taken place. We just didn't find it.
Are you asking farmers and gardeners, homeowners to look for these insects now?
The Fruit and Vegetable Growers Association, they'll be talking about this all winter, how to make these simple little traps with just a little bit of vinegar will be discussed at all of our meetings. Our master gardeners, our county horticulturists, our county extension offices are going to be talking about this so that people can be on the lookout for it. They can begin the detection program. We're also going to have to upgrade our sanitation in our gardens and in our fruit production areas to make sure that any fruit, any berry that isn't quite right, anything that's collapsed, pitted, starting to decay, we just don't drop it on the ground. We get rid of it completely, bury it, haul it away, get it away from the fruit area. Sanitation is going to be one of our first management options to prevent this from establishing in your garden, in your fruit production area, because insecticides are a really poor choice. And then the monitoring will also be part of that. So we're going to encourage people to monitor for their own benefit and hope they will share their results with us and let us know what they find along the way.
So you want people to keep do a better job of keeping the fruit that falls to the ground picked up or taken away. But you don't have a spray that you can recommend? Is there anything else in the management plan so far?
Not really. This is going to be a tough one because the flies attack the fruit as the fruit is just approaching maturity. You're just about ready to harvest it. It's the time you really, really don't want to add insecticide to the crop. But in order to protect it those last few days, we may have to be spraying insecticides. What we spray at that time is going to depend upon whether you're an organic producer or a conventional producer. It's also going to depend on what we learn this winter from our neighboring states that are doing more of the research to determine what is the best choice, how do we use those tools to our best advantage, and still get a nutritious and safe product out of the commercial vegetable and fruit production.
Have they been controlling them in Hawaii all these years?
With sprays, with early picking, with sanitation, and I think you and I should be given tickets to go to Hawaii to find out the answer to that question.
That would make a great hour of radio, Donald.
That's right.
Absolutely positive.
We will go to Hawaii and research this for them, and we will report back soon.
All right. Well, we've put up a link to the press release about the spotted winged Drosophila fly that has been detected in Story County, Iowa. I'm talking with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We're going to take a quick break. Richard Giron will be here when we get back, horticulturist from Iowa State University Extension. And of course, Richard and Donald are here to answer your questions about plants and bugs. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. I've been talking with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, and now joining us is Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here again today, and the phones are already lighting up. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. John is on the line first from Dubuque. Hello, John.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
I love this show. I have two questions. First one concerns a hardy hibiscus I have, and I want to know when is a good time to transplant it. How do you prune it? When do you prune it? And the second question is relating to your discussion about the fly. We have a lot of fruit in our house. I've noticed there's a lot of fruit flies around. Is there anything that I can do here to see if we've got those flies? And what I'll do is I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for your call, John. And should we start with hibiscus, Richard?
Okay. As far as moving that early in the spring, just as new growth begins to emerge from the ground. And as far as cutting back the debris, I'd probably do that in late winter.
All right. And Donald, should he be looking out for the new fruit fly?
He certainly could. Dubuque is close enough to Wisconsin that it could have already happened there and could happen. But we are at the time of the year where we get our usual fruit fly in the house around the tomatoes, around the muskmelons, and around the other fruits that you have on the kitchen counter. Those could be just wandering in from outside. The outdoor world is full of the regular fruit fly, Drosophila melangaster. And the way we're going to tell them apart is you got to get them down, hold them stationary, get out a really good magnifying glass, and look for the spot in the wings of the males. So you're going to have at least two fruit flies to kind of rule out or rule in that that's what you've got, because only half of the population has those spots. Now, one way to watch for fruit flies in your house is to put out a little bowl of vinegar. I hate to suggest wasting the red wine, but you could put out a little saucer of red wine. The fruit flies will be attracted to that. They will fall in and drown. Then you sort of fish them out, get out your magnifying glass, and take a look at them.
All right, and while we're on the subject of fruit flies, we have a couple other questions coming in by email about them. Is there something special I should be doing with my compost into which I put fruit rinds, et cetera, to help avoid this critter? That's from Fred.
Yeah. Well, Fred, if you are composting, and if it is heating up, and if it's steaming on a cool winter morning, if you're reaching those temperatures of 140 to 180 degrees at the center of the compost pile, no problems. All the fly larvae or eggs that might be in those rinds are going to disappear. If you can just get them to break down quickly, it's not going to be a problem. But generally, it's not going to be very many rinds. It's going to be the whole fruits that we're going to know that are infested, and it's going to be a little more of a challenge to get rid of those quickly. Burial is one possibility. Tying them up in a black plastic bag would be another. So if you have suspicious fruit, I might take an extra step. Up to this point, nope, just keep your compost working and churning and turn it often.
All right, and this is about regular fruit flies. This is from Stefan in Ames. He said, what might be a good countertop fruit fly trap to keep them away from my fruit?
Well, you can make little vinegar saucers. That will help. It sort of attracts them and lures them down to the far end. Put the fruits in bags or the ones that can be refrigerated, could be refrigerated to keep the flies off of them. This is just such a tough time of the year because we love these cool temperatures. We have the doors and windows open now that we didn't have open in the middle of the summer. Fruit flies that are outside are going to ride in with the produce. They may be attracted into the food odors. What we want to watch for is when the weather gets cold, if you still have fruit flies, then you have to consider maybe you're breeding them in the drain of your basement shower. You're breeding them in the floor drain that doesn't get much water into it, or a tub that runs very slowly. So later in the winter, if you still have fruit flies, check back and we'll give you more information on that. But right now, little traps with just a bit of vinegar is one way to attract the fruit flies away from the other. They'll fall in and drown.
All right. I'm talking with Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist, and Richard Geron, horticulturist. I can no longer speak, from Iowa State University Extension. And you're welcome to join our conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. I practiced Drosophila so much, I think that I've now lost the ability to say other things that
I
normally can say.
There's a lot of big names in your industry.
Right. All right. Walt is on the line next from Mason City. Hi, Walt.
Hello. Question is, my tomatoes are being attacked by what we used to call picnic bugs or potato bugs. I don't know what their real name is. I call them tomato bugs at the moment. But I'm surprised they're even attacking the green ones. Is there any way that we can get rid of those or discourage them?
It's not going to be easy, and we're at the end of the season where their population has just had all summer to increase. There are lots of names for that. Many charity will not allow me to say on the air. but picnic bug is certainly one of them. The family of those shiny patent black beetles is called the sap beetle. beetles, and that explains why they are on tree wounds, why they are on overripe fruit, why they are on the broken end of your tomatoes and your muskmelons. The shiny black one with four dots on it is cleverly named the four-spotted sap beetle, but picnic bug is what I grew up calling them as well. Pick early, pick often is the best I can tell you at this time of the year. Very clean picking as well. No cracked, damaged, dropped fruit allowed in that area. Some people, and I don't know how big a portion of this is, some people find it successful to lure them away from the garden with a bucket with some muskmelon rinds in it. Muskmelon turns out to be one of their favorites. So you put this 10, 20 feet away from the garden, you put some muskmelon rinds in there, and then you dust the muskmelon rinds just lightly with 7 insecticide dust. This bait bucket is supposed to be more attractive to the beetles, the sap beetles, than your garden. Some days I think that's naive, wishful thinking. Some days it seems like it works. And if nothing else, you get to kill a lot of sap beetles over there in your bucket with the melon rinds. So just like Stefan wanted to lure the fruit flies down to the far end of the counter with a bit of a trap, you could do that with sap beetles as well.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Walt. And next up is Gordon on the line in West Branch. Hello, Gordon.
Good morning. My question for Mr. Lewis is the butterfly population in decline right now, or I just haven't observed very many butterflies this year and haven't seen any migration?
We are at that time where we almost should be seeing the migration coming down out of the northern parts of the North America on the way to Mexico when we're talking about the monarch butterfly. Of course, last spring we had this explosion of red admiral butterflies. We had some very early monarchs who were passing through on their way north. Then the rain stopped and it hit 100 degrees and the butterfly population just crashed. The monarchs that we had very early just went on past us and they were reproducing further north, and we didn't get the reproduction of monarchs here in central Iowa that we normally get. Back to your original question, though, monarchs, butterflies in general, but let's talk about monarchs, butterflies specifically, are in a 10-year decline in populations. They have had very tough weather in Mexico, making it through the winter. They've had very dry, droughty conditions in Texas, where they are supposed to reproduce in February and March so that we get a large flux later in the season. That's two strikes. And then when they get to Iowa, the milkweeds that they depend upon have all been killed with Roundup herbicide. So as we have increased our use of Roundup herbicide in corn and soybean fields, the food supply for the monarchs has been in decline. All these strikes have caused this 10-year measurable, noticeable, documented decline in monarch butterfly populations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call, Gordon. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. If you have a question about your garden or your yard or some insects, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. We have a couple of lines open for you right now. And let's do an email question here. This is from Les. Can I prune my spirea now to shape it up for winter? I didn't do it earlier because of the drought conditions.
You could, but I'd prefer to wait and do that probably in March of next spring.
All right.
Won't spirea just take it, though? Isn't that so tough you can't do it wrong?
It's difficult. I mean, it's a very, very tough, resilient plant. But we typically like to avoid pruning in late summer because it possibly might encourage a late flush of growth, which then wouldn't winter hardy, and so you might have some winter dieback. So usually we suggest doing it in late winter, early spring.
Well, and this year, wouldn't even some of the toughest plants be stressed?
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. They're under quite a bit of heat and drought stress, so I would be inclined not to put them under additional stress at this point, too.
All right. Susan's on the line next from Fairfield. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm just wondering about this cucumber beetle infestation, but I don't think they're cucumber beetles because they're horizontally striped, not lengthwise on the body. And hello?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, they're all over inside the house and outside. They fly. They have long antennae, and they kind of twitch. But they look almost like a kind of a roach.
Yeah. The silence matched the puzzled look on my face because I was scrambling through my mental database trying to come up with an insect that had the had stripes going sideways.
Right, green and like brownish black.
Green and brownish black stripes that go sideways. And what is the length of the insect?
Well, there are babies that are pretty bright green, but the older ones are maybe like a little longer than a quarter of an inch, and they're more of a yellowish cast.
Yeah. Boy, I'm still coming up blank. Oh. This was another one of those painful moments for me when it feels like something I should know. And these moments are always doubly painful, Charity, because when I do figure this out, I'm going to slap my forehead and say, oh, why didn't I think of that?
And it'll probably be right after the radio show ends, too.
Oh, yeah. Walking back to my office, it will come to me. Gee, Susan, I'm coming up blank on what this would be, both indoors and outdoors, with horizontal stripes, quarter inch long, bright green to yellowish green.
Yeah, they're sort of phasing out now. They're really, really prominent in August. So big flux of them. But the adjunct question is, there's a very mature black chestnut tree in the backyard that has these tiny green, well, not actually tiny. It's completely filled with these green hard pods that are on every leaf. And now those are turned brown and hardening, but I'm thinking that the tree is a goner.
Not from this. Maybe drought, maybe any other insults it's had. But what you described was a hickory gall, and the galls form at the time the leaf is growing.
Yeah.
And they are there all year, and then as the leaf senesces in the fall of the year, the galls turn brown, occasionally a little faster than the leaf tissue around it.
Right.
But trees put up with that quite well, and hickory has a couple of common ones, and there's a couple of other. You did say hickory, didn't you?
I didn't hear that.
Black chestnut?
Oh, chestnut.
Yeah, black.
Oh, chestnut. I'm sorry. I don't know why I heard chestnut and wrote down hickory. But, yes, the galls are not a big problem. They're another little stress, and in a normal year, we wouldn't think anything about them, but we don't want any additional stresses on this tree, so give it tender, loving care. In the meantime, is it possible for you to take a picture of the bright green, quarter-inch-long striped beetles and send that to me? Insects. I'm not even sure they're beetles now.
Yeah,
And
sure.
Send that to me.
Had a collection a while ago, but I think they're all expired now. So.
Well, dead ones are much easier to photograph than live ones.
Okay.
It's much easier to focus your camera. And as we keep telling people, if you're going to send us a digital image, there are three things that are critical. One is to focus the picture. Second is focus. And the third one is to focus.
Focus, okay.
So rather than getting closer, work on the focus. And then send your digital image to insects. It's plural, I-N-S-E-C-T-S, insects, at iastate.edu.
Okay.
Insects at iastate.edu. So snap a photo, a good clear one, and wait to hear the sound of my hand slapping my forehead when I see what these little insects are, and then we'll send you back a message.
Okay, and then with the tree, you just hope that it just rebounds next year with a fresh batch of leaves, or is it going to be like this forever?
Well, the galls themselves shouldn't cause serious harm, but they may be back next year depending on environmental conditions, weather conditions. So I would expect to see that at least to some extent next year. As far as what you can do, you could go out and possibly water the tree if it's extremely dry, and yet do that maybe this fall.
All right, Susan, thanks so much for your call. And this is from Lauren. He wants to know the ever-present question, how to control trumpet vine. Our yard is a continual battle to keep the runners under control.
Well, it's a long-term project. It may take 2 or 3 years. I think the best way of doing it is to cut off the shoots and immediately apply Roundup to the cut surface. And when you do that, use the Roundup concentrate that you normally dilute, but in this case don't, and just use a foam-type paintbrush, dip the paintbrush into that Roundup, and then dab it on the cut surface. And you have to be persistent. It's a very, very resilient plant, very tough, very aggressive, and it will keep on sending up shoots, and you have to be just as persistent. So it probably will take 2 or 3 years, but if you're persistent, it can be done.
So this is a hobby. This is something to
it will be
pursue
for a couple
over
years.
The next couple of years.
Yeah, it might even turn into a lifetime hobby.
I hope not.
I don't think so. Do all trumpet vines form suckers? Are there some varieties that just go up the windmill and don't spread out?
Like most plants, some really sucker very, very heavily, and others just a few. But oftentimes when you make an attempt to kill it, then it really starts to sucker.
It goes
because
into overdrive.
Survival mode. It's in survival mode, and it just suckers everywhere. So,
all right. And Lauren also wanted to mention that he and his wife keep a small, flat chip dip container with a little bit of cider vinegar and a drop or two of dish soap. He puts some holes in the lid, and his fruit flies find it right away.
And you can buy commercial fruit fly traps. If you go online, you can buy them as well. But I certainly like Lauren's idea of a butter container.
All right, it's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis, horticulturist Richard Giron from ISU Extension, and we're here to talk to you. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, tweet us at IPR Talk, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture and Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension entomologist. They're here to answer your questions about insects, about plants, about your garden, about your yard. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Mary is on the line next from Johnston. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I have to replace my raspberry patch, and I've torn them all out, and I wondered if I could plant them this fall, and do I need to move to a different site?
You should move to a different site, because that site may have contaminated soil as far as plant pathogens, and as far as planting this fall, not very a good option. I would plant next spring.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Mary. Bye-bye. Next up is Sally in Iowa City. Hi, Sally.
Yep.
What's your question?
I'm probably getting a one-word answer here. I have a tall hedge, privacy hedge, between our condo association and our neighbors, about 30-foot tall cedars. There are about 18 of them, and the first three are dead, look brown. Then there's a green one, and there's another brown one, and the rest of them look great. My question is, do we just have to cut down the brown ones? Is there any hope cedars will refoliate?
Well, if these are arborvitae, this hot, dry summer has been really, really tough on them. Even well-established plants have died. And we think it's basically due to the hot, dry conditions. Arborvitae have very few insect and disease pests, but this weather has been very, very hard on them. And if they turn totally brown, they're basically dead.
Yep, that's what I figured.
that's unfortunate. So if you go out there and if you grab some of the foliage, and that dried foliage is dry and crumbly,
yep.
It's dead, unfortunately.
Okay, that's what I figured.
All right, bummer,
Thank you,
Sally.
Very much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye. Next up, we've got Karen on the line in Ames. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been getting pop-up ads on my computer regarding a bed bug outbreak in Ames, and I am wondering if that is, there's some documented uptick of bed bugs in Ames, and also... I do know a young man whose roommate has bed bugs in his bedroom in their apartment, and they're wondering if it's possible to fight them yourselves or whether you need professional help.
Everybody has bed bugs. Everybody is equally at risk. There's nothing unique or different about Ames. This is just somebody's clever use of social media as an advertising option or opportunity. No, we don't have any more than anybody else. Everybody's got them. In fact, we hear about fewer problems in Ames than we do some of the larger metropolitan areas, but everybody is at risk. As far as treatments, do-it-yourself is not advised. The problem with do-it-yourself treatment is, number one, the chemicals, the insecticides that we can obtain to get to do it ourselves are not effective. The resistance problem is just so widespread. They are so thoroughly resistant to the common insecticides that what you can buy over the counter is not going to work. Second thing, yeah, you cannot heat your apartment hot enough with your furnace, with your hair dryer. You just can't get up to that 130, 135 degrees that it takes to kill bed bugs. Oh, and the temperature has to be 135 where they hide, not up here in the air around us. So heat, you're not going to be able to do that yourself. Boric acid powder that you put out will kill bed bugs, but you're never going to get enough of it out. You're not going to get all the hiding places. You're not going to be able to do it thoroughly enough. And finally, in an apartment complex, it's not just your problem. It is all of the adjoining apartments that should be checked and probably need to be treated as well. So everybody to the left, right, front, back, up, down, and horizontally or diagonally off of the corners is also at risk from this infestation, which is why all of it adds up to you need professional treatment. You need to call at least three different companies to get estimates and proceed from there.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Karen. And next up, let's go to Don on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Don.
Good morning.
What's your question?
I have two trees that were hurt by the late frost last spring, a cottonwood and a locust. After the frost, there was a lot of blooms. They were in a bloom stage at the time, if I remember right. And a lot of those blooms end up turning dark and falling on the ground. Both trees were slow to recover. The cottonwood pretty much did. The locust this year is the least or the most sparse I've ever seen it. And the real problem is on the higher branches, there were some nodules that seemed to grow where the blooms had been. And I would say they're probably, some of those might be 3/4 of an inch in diameter. Does this sound like anything you've ever heard of?
One question. Was your lawn treated professionally last year as far as a herbicide?
It was treated by lawn service. So, yeah, there would have been some broadleaf control, yes.
Okay. Do you have any idea what they applied?
No.
Okay, you might want to check into that. There was a herbicide that was initially used early last spring. It was Imprelis. And Imprelis was thought to be a good herbicide, but in fact, it caused extensive damage to many trees, especially things like Norway spruce, white pine, but also some deciduous trees. And they quickly took it off the market, but it was used for a few weeks in the spring. We're still seeing damage caused by Imprelis this year in 2012. We're seeing, in the case of honey locust, we're seeing these wart-like growths on the branches, okay? Little knobs on the branches.
That's exactly it, and yes, he did use Imprelis early in the year, and I got a letter, but they were only talking about certain evergreens, and they were not talking about other deciduous trees, so
okay.
I didn't pay attention beyond that because the other one wasn't damaged. The evergreen trees weren't damaged.
Yeah, they're still seeing damage in 2012. In fact, if you go to some of the websites from Purdue and other universities, the damage this year is actually much more severe, and they're finding it on trees and shrubs that they didn't see last year. So
yeah.
I'm guessing a small amount of that, at least some of that, is due to the herbicide Imprelis. Now, if it is Imprelis, there's not much you can do. You could water the tree so it doesn't have to deal with heat and drought stress. You probably shouldn't fertilize the tree because apparently if you fertilize it, it makes it more sensitive to the Imprelis herbicide, so don't fertilize it. You can prune out any dead branches, that would be good, but that's about it. But I'm guessing those nodules are probably due to the herbicide Imprelis.
Okay. And will they? Well, likely. Well, first of all, it was last year, and it was early, and they did take it away after the first application. So, do you expect it to show up again with new growth, or do you think it's one-time damage? Will it kill the tree? Is it just ugly? What? How would you characterize this whole thing?
Only time will tell. I would be very curious as far as next spring. Does it leaf out well? And if it does, I'd be very encouraged. If it leaves out very poorly and I see additional nodules on the tree, then I would tend to be pessimistic that eventually this tree might decline and die. So it's kind of the trend. What is the trend? And you may have to wait another year or two to see that.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Don. And next up, we'll go to Teresa from Illinois. Hello, Teresa.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I've got a question about the old chestnut trees that used to be in the country. I know they got all pretty well killed by a blight, and I know they are also trying to breed them for resistance to this blight. Do you know if they're commercially available yet?
I'm not sure on that. You can, as far as the chestnut, the American chestnut was bothered by chestnut blight, which basically destroyed most of the trees. There is a Chinese chestnut, and that can be grown in the southern half of Iowa, and it will produce an edible chestnut. So that definitely would be an option. As far as cultivars of the American chestnut, I think they're working on that. I think they're trying some plantings in like Tennessee and some other states, but I'm not sure if that's working out at this point.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your call, Teresa. Next up, John on the line in Lockridge. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I got a couple of are fleas in my yard and bothering my dogs. Is it worse in a drought year than normal years?
No, in fact, we usually don't find fleas out in the middle of the yard. It's too hot, it's too dry, there's nothing there for them. Fleas are nest dwellers. Originally, they would have stayed in the little den, they would have stayed in the nest that the animal built for itself. And so we usually find fleas where the host is dwelling or spending the most time. Now, what we call cat flea that gets on our dogs, a bit of an embarrassment to the dogs, I might add, that cat flea is also very common on raccoons. So you can have flea populations surrounding you, and they're feeding on other hosts besides just your pets. But it's usually not the hot, dry center of the lawn. It's under the porch where the dog sleeps all day. It's over there under the tall shrubs where the raccoons have built a little nest or something, or the rabbits, something over there, because fleas develop in the nest of the animal. We usually don't have fleas in our lawns in Iowa. You only have to move to southern Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, to where it does become a problem having fleas in your lawn, but that's usually not our problem. And, of course, mostly now we control fleas by treating our pets with the topical applications of systemic insecticides.
Right, and I've been treating them with that, and I've been spraying down their bedding areas with, this stuff that you're supposed to shoot around the foundation of your home to keep the ants out and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I've been trying lots of different stuff that says, anything that says flea on it, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to go with, next I'm going to try a bear product that you put on the end of your hose, you know, and just, I guess, drench all around my house and...
Lots of broad
outside dogs, you know.
Yeah, lots of broad spectrum insecticides will help control fleas, but because fleas are frequently sort of hidden in the cracks and crevices of these little inaccessible areas, the spray may not work as well. I would concentrate on the edges, the perimeter, the secretive areas, and not put so much right out in the broad sunshine if you're going to use those insecticide products.
All right, John, thanks for your call. Let's go to an email. This is from someone who says, my neighbor has a large pear tree. There are many pears that are on the ground rotting. The neighbor occasionally picks them up and puts them on top of dead branches he's piled up. We do have a ton of gnats. I'll look for the dark spots on the wing of the male, as well as putting vinegar out. Any suggestions of what to do with the pears?
Well, it's going to be a big issue if no one is harvesting, if no one is using. discarding is sort of a hard thing to talk about because there are so many different regulations for so many different people. Some of you have large lawns and you own a backhoe, and burying a large amount of fruit would not be an issue. I have a small yard and a spade. If I had to bury that many pears, it would be the rest of the year to get it done. Maybe just spreading them and drying them in the sunshine would be an easier thing to do, or bag them up and get rid of them with your yard waste. Most of us, at least those of us in municipalities, can't put spare fruits and twigs and things in our garbage because we have a yard waste pickup instead. So this becomes a difficult issue. What do I do with these large amounts of fruits that I want to get rid of? Put them in a black plastic bag, set them in the sunshine. I can keep coming up with all kinds of options, but no option is going to be right for everybody.
All right. Let's go to Wilbur on the line in Sioux City. Hi, Wilbur.
Good morning. My question is this. So what's the best time and how do you trim a yew bush?
I would say a very good time would be April. And at that time, right before it begins to grow, you can prune it back fairly severely. Now, you can also prune lightly later on in the summer, like around July or August. That's fine. But as far as the more severe pruning, basically probably in Sioux City, probably around early to mid-April.
All right, Wilbur, thanks a lot for your call. Let's see if we can slip one more call in here. Here's Paul on the line from Fairfield. Hi, Paul.
Hey there. We've got a really dry lawn, and it's had some mushrooms, but now it's giving us like black fungus or something. We don't know what it is, these little dark patches.
Okay. Now, if you take your hand and swipe it across the area, does it get kind of blackish or bluish in color?
Powdery?
My wife's been pulling these things up, so I haven't seen the texture, okay. But she actually pulls them up. You know, they're like dark mushroom things.
Some type of mushroom, okay, or toadstools.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
Like that, but it's very low to the ground, though. It doesn't stand up like normal mushrooms.
And under what type of tree?
Oh, I don't know. We're new residents in this house, but so it's definitely under a tree, yeah.
Okay. I can't identify the actual fungus or toadstool, but as far as control, the only thing you can do is to pick them as they appear and discard them. You can't put anything on the ground to prevent their reoccurrence. So you basically deal with them as they appear, basically pick them and destroy them.
All right, Paul, and time for one more email. I planted about 3 dozen tree seedlings this spring, 2 to 3-year-old deciduous seedlings, except for the one I killed by girdling it with the weed trimmer, ARG, is written there. I have kept them all alive by applying 9 to 10 gallons of water per week to each through spring and summer. How late into autumn should I continue to water them? Also, regardless of weather conditions next year, should I continue to water them for another year or two?
I would keep on watering them, if it's dry, into early to mid-November. And then next spring and summer, if we have another dry year, then I would water again probably every 10 to 14 days. If we have, I would say, normal rainfall, they should be okay.
All right, Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension. Donald Lewis, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension Entomology. Horticulture Day will be back next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan and Jason Burns. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on the show, a new exhibit is coming to Coralville that portrays the human toll of war in Afghanistan. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.